Right now, health. Now, on a very general level, there are two aspects to our nation's health system. There's the public system, where care is either fully paid for or subsidised by you and me, the taxpayer. Problem is, outside of emergency treatment, there are often long waiting lists for public care. So you can take out insurance and get your insurer to pay for you to get that treatment or surgery done by a private hospital. Or if you're really wealthy, you can just pay for it yourself. Now, there are a few issues that this throws up. One is the public system is overloaded sometimes. A lot of folk find themselves on waiting lists that are months, even years long, and they can't afford health insurance. Then there's the fact that many specialists working in the public system also work in the private system. And then there's the cost of public health care when the private treatment goes awry and the patient needs emergency treatment in a public hospital. And that's where my next guest comes in, Dr. Erin Penno, Research Fellow, Preventive and Social Medicine, University of Otago, talking about how private health patients are costing the public system. Kia ora, Erin.
Kia ora, Brian.
Nice to have you on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Now, okay, the first thing I was struck I thought if you went private, well, the private pays for, you paid for it, your insurers paid for it. There's nothing to do with the public system at all.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's what most people would think, and I think in the vast majority of cases that is true. But like you were just outlining, you know, we do tend to think that the public and private systems are quite separate, but there is actually quite a lot of crossover. So the clinicians work in both systems, and as you were just saying, the private sector tends to it lacks the sort of specialist follow-up care that you find in the public system. So things like intensive care units, they're not in all private hospitals. After-hours care doesn't tend to be provided, so you'd have to go to your local emergency department. So we knew that anecdotally there was evidence that patients were shifting from the private to public sectors, but we were quite interested in quantifying that and getting to grips with how frequently that was happening and what it cost.
Erin, are we talking here about an emergency event, somebody's received some private treatment or surgery, and then something goes wrong?
Yeah, in the main, I think that's what we were picking up in our study. By and large, the sorts of things that people were popping up for readmissions into the public system were for complications of that care, so things like bleeds, hematomas, or infections. So I think they're the sorts of things you'd probably see people moving into ED for.
Why doesn't the private system that actually did the care in the first place, why doesn't it pick up the tab? Why doesn't it deal with something that may be their responsibility?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there will be cases when they do pick up on a lot of post-care, but there will be times when they just don't have the facilities available. They're not running 24/7 kind of facilities in a lot of cases. So it falls to the public system to basically pick that up.
What sort of things are we talking about here?
In terms of
what sort of problems that we find somebody who's gone private ends up in the public system?
Yeah. So when we were looking at the data, the reasons people were moving from the private into the public system, it was largely for those sorts of complications of care. So things like a hematoma or an infection or some other sort of complication following the procedure that they'd had. It's quite hard to sort of get to the real nitty gritty of what's causing that in the data that we had. But yeah, just those sorts of complications.
And your data is over what time period?
So we had a look at readmissions that occurred in the period from 2013 through to 2014. And the reason that we had a look at that time period was because that was around the time that the completeness of data submitted by the private system to the Ministry of Health was becoming more complete. So the private system or sector isn't actually compelled to submit data, it's voluntary. So historically, there's actually been quite poor data. So that was about the sort of the first time frame we were able to sort of start looking at that and get a baseline.
And what is the price in terms of the public system picking up the tab when something in the private system doesn't quite hit the spot?
Yeah, so we found about 2%, so not a great deal of patients in the private sector were moving through to the system, so that's equivalent to just over 1,800 people, but it costs the taxpayer about $11.5 million. So not insubstantial.
Not insubstantial, but then if we compare the multi-billion dollar expense of the public health system, I am right about it being more than a billion or two or three.
Oh, yeah, it's huge sums. So it would be in excess of $20 billion that we spend on healthcare in New Zealand. So, yeah, when you look at it in that context, it doesn't sound like a really great deal. But just to try and contextualise that a little bit more, $11.5 million would fund the cost of a small town, the healthcare of a small town for a year, or it would be equivalent to around 760 hip replacements. So it does add up. It does make an impact.
Does the public system levy private providers if something goes wrong?
To try and recoup those costs?
Yes.
To my knowledge, they don't. And I think, you know, that's an interesting question over whether or not they should. There might be some sort of unintended consequences around that if they were to go down that route, which are things like, so it could drive the private system to basically engage in cream skimming, where they're only going to take on people who have a low risk of a readmission or complications, or it might actually just drive up the already quite high premiums that people see, particularly for groups who are probably more likely to be readmitted, such as the elderly. And I think it would be quite costly on both sides. So it's not free to try and recoup costs. There's the costs both of the DHB and the private sector. So I think it's quite a complex kind of solution trying to go down that route.
I imagine that private providers would argue that they are more efficient and therefore allowing, even if we allow for this $11.5 million, if there was no private care, if all the stuff was done by public, it would cost a lot more than the $11.5 million that the public system is currently having to pick up when a private operation or treatment doesn't quite work.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm not able to say whether or not that's the case based on the work that we did in our study. But I think another argument that gets used by the private sector is that also actually the care they provide comes at no cost to the public system. And, you know, we can see now that that's clearly not the case. So it's the sort of the dynamics between the two systems, I don't think are really clearly understood here in New Zealand.
I guess one of the things that interests me about the dichotomy in terms of public and private care, is that, as you pointed out, and even I pointed out in the intro to this to our discussion, that there are a lot of specialists who work both in the public sector and the private sector. And it might be, okay, the private sector pays for them, they are paid in the private sector, but there's the question of time. You can only do one operation at a time, generally, if you're a surgeon.
Yeah.
If you end up spending more time working in the private sector because they pay you more, you got less time to work in the public sector where there's already lots of waiting lists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is quite a tension in our system. There was research done by a colleague of mine some years back that looked at whether or not private sector provision decreased the load on the public system, and she found it didn't. And I think that's one of those complicating factors, is that we have only a limited pool of specialists. What are the sort of, things that pull them into the private sector is something that we're really interested in understanding more about too.
What are the things that maybe could be put in place so that the public system gets recompensed for that $11.5 million?
Mm. What are the things they could do?
Is there anything?
I don't know. I mean, I think, again, that is a really interesting question. I think, first of all, it's important to try and understand what's happening and having the data available to understand that and to show that. And that was one of the conclusions from our study, that really that this should be being reported by government as well. They tend to focus on what's happening in the public system. And I don't know that this is recognition that the private and public system do intermesh quite a lot. I think, you know, there's probably scope for DHBs, if they are aware that this is a particular problem, for them to have more of a conversation with the private providers in their area and see whether or not, you know, there's anything they could do sort of proactively reduce readmissions and what they could do to try and mitigate the costs that are being passed on to the public system.
I don't know if this is an area you can answer, or a question you can answer, but is there any evidence that if there was a limit on how much work a publicly funded specialist could do in the private sector, whether that would create more, would reduce the waiting list in the public sector? Is there a link between how much work some specialists do in the private sector and how long the waiting list is in the public sector?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure of the answer to that question. I think it's an interesting one. I mean, there are health systems internationally which just say, you know, outright you can't go into the private system for anything that's available in the public system. Like Canada does that, I think, in a lot of cases. So, you know, there are models out there that do that. I'm not sure how popular that would be in New Zealand's health system for the clinicians working in that area. I mean, that would be interesting to explore with them.
Well, it might be a case of maybe the public sector would have to pay them more to win them over.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I think there are other reasons potentially too that people are going into the private sector. So internationally, I think there's some evidence that they, I guess, the kind of the clinical autonomy that they gain from working in the private sector, they quite enjoy.
There's maybe another thing that drives them is that the... And again, you can perhaps shed some light on this. I mean, I guess the perceived wisdom is that the public sector is under a lot of strain, and therefore, if you want better working conditions, less stress, you'd work in a private hospital.
Yeah, and I mean that may well be the case for people. I think, you know, the public system is under a lot of strain, and I think it can be quite a difficult place to be for some people. That may well be something that means that people also favour working in the private system. But that question of why clinicians engage in dual practice is something that we're really keen to understand more about. We're hoping to do some more studies looking into that and trying to understand the sort of motivations and experiences of clinicians in both settings.
How much has our system changed over the last two or three decades? How many more people rely on the private sector and private insurance to get the treatment that they believe they need compared to, say, the end of the 80s?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I don't know that I can answer it definitively. I do know that the number of people who've had insurance over, you know, decades long has fluctuated a bit, but sort of in recent years we've seen the number of people with private health insurance growing. And that is probably a reflection of that strain that, you know, we've been talking about, that people are concerned that they're not able to access timely care in the public system. And so if they can afford it, that insurance provides a really... I guess kind of a fallback option.
Where are you going next with this research, Erin?
So we're really keen to have a look at the data since 2014 and have a look at trends over time and understand whether or not the pattern of readmissions has changed, so whether it's increased or decreased, and what the costs are, whether or not they're sort of staying fairly static or they're actually going up. We're also really keen to try and understand a bit more about the dynamics and the relationship between the private and public sector, so sort of mapping that out, understanding a little bit more about the motivations of clinicians who engage in that dual practice between both public and private, but also trying to understand the motivations and experience of patients who seek out private care. So, you know, what are the reasons that they're doing it? Is it because they're concerned that they won't have access to care? Is it because they think they're getting better quality care? So, as you said, the same clinicians are likely to be treating them in both the public and private system. But, yeah, just understanding that a bit more.
Erin, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
It's been great. Thank you.
That's Dr. Erin Pienaar, Research Fellow, Preventive and Social Medicine at Otago University.